Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. On today's show, we'll hear a presentation by Steve Masek, professor of communications at North Central College in Naperville, Illinois, where he discussed the early political history of radio in the United States. But now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
President Obama's Nobel Peace Prize is as phony as the plastic prize in a Cracker Jack box, full of empty rhetorical calories and poisonous substances. The Norwegian Nobel Committee completed its nominations process only 11 days after Obama took office and chose him based on their own wishful assumptions of what he might do as president. In the real world, among his first acts was to present to the Congress the biggest military budget in the history of the world, to fund a United States armed forces that is more lethal and costly than all the rest of the militaries on the planet combined. A previous Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., lamented back in 1967 that the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. President Obama has expanded on that legacy of death and destruction. He now owns the conflict in Afghanistan and Pakistan, which has justifiably been dubbed Obama's war. He refuses to renounce the use of nuclear arms against Iran and presses relentlessly forward with the militarization of Africa through the steady buildup of the U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM. The United States remains complicit in the ongoing genocide in the Congo, where at least 5 million people have perished in the corporate scramble for the region's natural resources. The Obama administration mercilessly hammers the people of Somalia, menacing that nation's sovereignty from the U.S. military base in Djibouti and inflaming tensions throughout the Horn of Africa. When Barack Obama declares that he is presiding over necessary wars, then those who seek peace must organize the necessary resistance to those wars. The world has waited long enough, no, too long, for President Obama to live up to the expectations of the 5 members of the Nobel Prize for Peace Committee in Norway. The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations has taken on the responsibility to reignite a Black-led movement to resist this administration's war policies at home and abroad. Peace requires that the U.S. join the International Criminal Court and face the music for its own crimes against humanity. But peace and social justice also require an end to a nationwide U.S. public policy of police containment of Black communities. That's why the Black is Back Coalition demands an end to mass Black incarceration and the release of political prisoners. Peace requires economic security for the people and an end to bailouts for the banks. On November 7th, the Black is Back Coalition will rally in Washington, D.C.'s Malcolm X Park and then march on the White House. On November 7th, Black America begins to reassume its historic place in the forefront of struggle. On November 7th, the Black is Back Coalition serves notice that a Black president gets no free pass when it comes to issues of social justice, peace, and reparations. For information on the rally in Washington, go to www.blackisbackcoalition.org. Forget what Barack Obama said at the 2004 Democratic Convention. There is a Black America, and Black is back. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stjepanchik. We now feature a presentation by Steve Masek, professor of communications at North Central College in Naperville, Illinois, where he discussed the early political history of radio in the United States. Steve Masek spoke as part of a presentation by the group Chicago Media Action at an event organized by the Open University of the Left at the Fullerton Branch Library in Chicago, recorded on Monday, October 12, 2009. A disclaimer, I myself am an active member of Chicago Media Action, and you'll hear me near the end of this presentation.
Radio during World War I in this country was actually, some of you may not know this, a government monopoly. Specifically, it was a military monopoly. All uses that were not related to the military were banned. And in fact, the Navy, and specifically the Signal Corps of the Navy, during World War I, drafted all of the amateur radio enthusiasts who had been building radios and so forth to come and work for the U.S. Navy, because radio technology was considered that important and that vital to the war effort. And there was actually an interesting debate that took place immediately following World War I about whether or not the Navy was going to give up control of radio. There were certain people affiliated with the Navy who were not interested in allowing radio to revert back to private control. They wanted it to remain a military monopoly. Nevertheless, the power of big business prevailed. Thanks largely to the efforts of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was at the time the Secretary of the Navy, the U.S. government formed a private but nationalistic monopoly corporation called RCA, the Radio Corporation of America, that really sort of presided, would have control over radio in this country. In the 1920s, people started to use radio not as a means of point-to-point communication, the way that it was used, you know, during World War I to communicate between ships or to communicate between soldiers in the field, but instead they started to use it as a broadcast medium. You'd have a single person transmitting out programming for multiple unknown receivers to receive as a form of entertainment. And this really got its start in the early 1920s. There was a station out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, run by a Westinghouse engineer called KDKA, which is often credited as being the very first broadcast station. This Westinghouse engineer started playing music over his radio transmitter and started reading out news reports, and that was the very first broadcast. And pretty quickly, every sort of institution in American society got into the act and started setting up their own radio stations. So virtually every college and university started their own radio station. The station that, one of the earliest ones, was in fact the station that's now WILL down at Champaign-Urbana. Even high schools started their own radio stations. An early one here in the Chicago area was Lane Tech High School that started its own radio station. Churches started their own radio stations. Department stores started up their own radio stations as a means of promoting their goods. So famous station started here in Chicago, WLS, was started by, does anyone know which department store? Sears, right? Because the call letters WLS stand for World's largest store. Mm-hmm. Newspapers, fearing competition from this new media, also started radio stations in droves. So the Chicago Tribune Company, under the leadership of Robert McCormick, started WGN. The call letters stand for World's Greatest Newspaper. The Daily News started WMAQ, and so forth. And you also had, here in Chicago, a very interesting innovation, which is here in Chicago we had a labor-run radio station. In fact, the only labor-run radio station anywhere in the country, WCFL. Since this is a group of people on the left, and I'm a person on the left, I want to spend a little bit more time talking about WCFL, since it's so unique and such a unique part of our broadcasting history. The Chicago Federation of Labor, at the time, was headed up by two guys, a secretary and, what was it, a secretary and president, Ed Knuckles and John Fitzpatrick, who were very independently minded and radical for leaders of a big metropolitan labor federation. What you've got to remember is the Chicago Federation of Labor back in the 19-teens actually started its own labor party and ran its own independent labor candidates because they were not satisfied with the representation they were getting from the Democratic Party, and they felt the Democratic Party was too reformist. In the 1920s, they started up a daily newspaper that was explicitly intended to compete with the capitalist press, with the Daily News, with the Times, and with the Chicago Tribune, because they felt that there needed to be a newspaper for quote-unquote those who toil. And unlike a lot of AFL-affiliated unions, and AFL-affiliated union-run newspapers, this newspaper opened its pages up to members of the IWW and later of the Communist Party. They were not scared of being associated with Reds, unlike so many other central labor bodies' newspapers. And so Chicago had a different kind of central labor body. And in particular, the secretary of the CFL, back in the teens and 20s, Ed Knuckles, was committed to labor having a voice in radio. And he actually lobbied the AFL and introduce legislations every year at the AFL's convention to push for a network of labor-affiliated radio stations. Well, the AFL was very conservative, and their response was, the commercial, if unions want to get their message out to the listening public, the way to do it is to rent time from commercial radio stations. Of course, that was a non-starter because the commercial radio stations adamantly refused to rent time to labor unions, no matter how moderate or reformist they might be for their programming. And so Ed Knuckles, thanks to his activism, got a radio station started here, which was called WCFL. It broadcast initially from a station, from a studio that located at the very tip of Navy Pier. Because the CFL had so much pull at City Hall, they were able to work out a deal where they were able to rent this vacated studio. It used to be run by the Navy for a single dollar a year to air their programming. And they put on a station that was not incredibly dissimilar from a lot of commercial stations. They did carry, the majority of their programming was music and entertainment programming, variety type theater and that sort of thing. But they did carry programming in a variety of different languages, the languages of the members of CFL. So they had programming in Yiddish, they had some programming in the Scandinavian languages. But what was really distinctive about WCFL is their news and public affairs programming came from a labor perspective and was hypercritical of the sort of pro-corporate propaganda that was the rule on WGN, for example, or any of the other area radio stations. I single out WCFL because they had a heck of a time getting on the air. In the early days, in the 1920s, the laws governing the regulation of the airways were not very clear-cut. And in fact, the Commerce Department was handling the licensing of radio stations. But the way that it was supposed to work, at least according to the laws that were on the books, was anyone who applied for an open frequency would automatically get a license to broadcast. And yet, when the Chicago Federation of Labor, which had constructed, you know, a transmitter and refurbished the studio and so forth, when they applied to the Commerce Department for a license to start broadcasting, they were told, no, you can't, because the airwaves in Chicago are simply too crowded. And Ed Knuckles was actually prepared to start broadcasting without permission of the U.S. government when a pioneering lawsuit came through, the so-called Zenith suit, that basically said that the Commerce Department didn't have the authority to pick and choose who could be on the airwaves because there was no enabling legislation saying that they had a right to deny anyone's application. And so they immediately granted WCFL their license. All right, well, this kind of gives you a little bit of this history of CFL, CFL getting on the airwaves. It gives you a little bit of a sense of what of the kind of cacophony that prevailed on radio in the 1920s. It wasn't exactly clear what the rules were governing who could get a license or not. It wasn't exactly clear the rules about who could broadcast at what power and on what frequency. It was sort of chaos, especially after this lawsuit that basically said the Commerce Department has to okay any application that comes into it for an open frequency. And so Congress started rushing to regulate the airwaves. And in fact, this might be one of the very few instances in American history where an industry begged the government to regulate it, begged the government to regulate it. Because the big broadcasters, the big corporate broadcasters, were terrified at the fact that tiny little stations, like stations broadcast by churches and high schools and so forth, that the signals from those stations were interfering with and undercutting their signals and interfering with this very expensive advertising-sponsored programming that they were running. Legions of lobbyists from various different groups with an interest in the future of broadcasting in the late 1920s descended on Congress to lobby about this this kind of the basic basic regulations that were going to be enacted governing radio. The first outcome of all of that lobbying was what's called the what was called the Radio Act of 1927. I mean, it's an important piece of legislation. What the Radio Act of 1927 did is it created an independent regulatory body from the Commerce Department called the Federal Radio Commission, the FRC. And it gave the FRC the right to either to accept or deny, importantly, or deny anyone's application for a license to broadcast. And moreover, it sort of laid out some general guidelines for the obligations of licensed broadcasters. It bound the holders of broadcast licenses to what's sometimes been called the PCAN principle. It said, in essence, PCAN stands for public interest, convenience, and necessity. And what the Radio Act said was anyone who's licensed to operate a radio station is doing so in the public public interest, convenience, and necessity. That they're basically the trustees of a kind of public trust. Now, I got to point out that they got this language directly from public utilities law. You'll find language like this in laws governing electrical systems, sewage systems, and so forth. So they were basically regulating radio broadcasting as if it were a public utility. But the problem here is that they didn't really define in the act itself what they meant by the public interest, convenience, and necessity. They left it very, very vague. And in fact, they left it up to the commissioners of the FRC to interpret that language. And who were the commissioners of the FRC? Well, I'm sad to say that they were all lawyers who worked for the big corporate, who at one time or another worked for the big corporate broadcasters. In fact, one of the most important figures in the early history of the FRC is this guy, Lewis Caldwell, who was actually a consultant to the Tribune Company about radio issues, was a lawyer who worked for Colonel Robert McCormick's law firm, Kirkland and Ellis, and was basically in the pay and on the payroll of the Tribune Company, and he was he had a huge role in sort of defining how the FRC interpreted in the public interest. And so, because I know we're kind of short on time, I'm going to sort of fast forward here and say one of the first acts then that the FRC undertook after it was created was what's sometimes called, or what is called, General Order Number 40, which was essentially designed an order that basically suggested that there were two types of radio stations. There were the small, not-for-profit, educational, non-commercial stations. And it suggested that they should have less priority than the well-funded, wealthy stations that had the money to broadcast, to install state-of-the-art technology in their studios, and to produce state-of-the-art, cutting-edge programming. And so technological capacity, right, and really the capital at disposal of radio stations became this sort of dividing line. And stations that were classified as small, non-commercial stations that lacked technical capacity could be pushed around. They could their place on the radio dial was changed so that they had to, say, take WCFL. WCFL had been broadcasting at 6:20 a.m. They were they were shoved to a different area on the broadcast spectrum to 6:10, and then later shoved over to 9:20. So they kept being moved around on the radio spectrum. It's very hard to build up an audience when your station is being moved all over the map. And secondly, those stations that were deemed to have technological capacity to do state-of-the-art broadcasting were given what's called a clear channel. That meant that nobody else could broadcast on their spectrum. Whereas stations that lacked technological capacity, like WCFL, would be forced to share spectrum with other stations. So in the case of WCFL, they actually had to briefly share a station or a channel with a station from Lane Tech High School. In response to this, there was, as you can imagine, a lot of outcry from the not-for-profit, non-commercial broadcasters, and especially WCFL and the leadership of WCFL actually led the fight to get this General Order 40 overturned. WCFL actually took some provocative steps. It applied, first of all, for a clear channel on the frequency that was being used by WBBM and demanded that there be a hearing about that. And then, to get even more provocative, a few years later, in 1930, they then applied for the frequency for 720 AM, which some of you may know is the frequency used by WGN. And they almost had a hearing about it. They got very close. They were very surprised when the FRC actually approved a hearing and then very quickly called it off at the last minute. But they took a lot of provocative steps because they felt like what the Radio Act had done was consolidate corporate control over the airwaves and marginalize the voices of educational broadcasters, labor broadcasters, and others. And Edward Knuckles, in particular, made a number of speeches, visited Congress to testify to the effect that the Radio Act had actually consolidated corporate control over radio. All right, fast forward up to 1934, which is the next sort of significant piece of legislation that affected the public's access to the airwaves, and that's the so-called communication. It's the Communication Act of 1934. In between 1927 and 1934, these activists, early media democracy activists, who felt like the FRC had been ignoring the public interest, started to lobby Congress in earnest. The ACLU got involved in lobbying on the behalf of what was called radio reform, and an organization called the National Committee on Education by Radio, which was an umbrella organization of all educational broadcasters, got together to lobby in Congress for substantial reform of radio. Because already by like 1930, it was clear that commercial broadcasting was already a vast wasteland. Long before the invention of television, it was already clear it was a vast wasteland, that radio airwaves were being used basically to sell soap and coffee and stupidity of various kinds. There was this sort of growing movement of people who wanted to change radio and reform it. And The problem was, as so often the case is, they couldn't agree on how they wanted to reform it. You had different camps pushing for different sorts of reforms. One camp, led by the WCFO folks and Ed Knuckles, were pushing for the creation of a true public service broadcasting system like they had in Britain, where you have government monopoly over radio, over broadcasting, but the corporation that runs it is independent, and it's publicly accountable in various ways. And Canada, to kind of recommend this solution even more, Canada had recently adopted its own version of a public service broadcasting system. So there were people in the US who were pushing for something like the BBC here in the United States. There were others who were what we might call the more moderate faction of the media reform activists of the 30s, represented by the National Committee on Education by Radio, who simply wanted a certain number of licenses set aside for educational uses. Some of them wanted 25% of all radio licenses set aside for educational uses. Some wanted 15%. In the end, since none of the activists, none of these people who were lobbying and pressuring Congress for reform could agree on what they wanted, they got nothing. And what happened ultimately was the 1934 Communication Act basically made the provisions of the Radio Act of 1927 permanent. It replaced the FRC with the FCC, the Federal Communication Commission. But I do want to suggest that they did, the sort of early media democracy activists did get a few things from all of the pressure they brought to bear on politicians. One thing that they got was a fairly limited licensure period. So in the early days, broadcasters would be licensed for only 3-year stints. So they would have to renew their license every 3 years, and that meant that every 3 years, at least theoretically, the public had the right to kind of weigh in on their performance. Second, the Communication Act of 34 did have some antitrust provisions. Specifically, in the early days, a single company could only own 7 broadcast outlets, only 7 radio stations. And that was a pretty severe restriction, because this is at a time when RCA is creating the National Broadcasting Corporation, the first radio networks, and they have the potential to extend those networks to hundreds of radio stations. If the government had allowed them to, they would have simply bought up hundreds of radio stations around the country and been effectively a private commercial radio broadcasting monopoly. So this actually, the Communication Act of 1934 did include some restrictions on the ability of these giant corporations to grow even bigger. And I guess I want to point out that by including still this requirement that broadcasting work in the public interest, convenience, and necessity, it left open some space that activists over the years have exploited to press the FCC to regulate broadcasters in a way that make them more responsive to the public interest and that have given the public more access to radio. For example, thanks to pressure from activists, the public finally got public standing in license renewal procedures, which means that when the FCC has a hearing on whether or not to renew a license, any member of the public has a right to write in and object to the renewal of that license, either to pose an informal objection to the renewal of that license, or to file an official objection to the renewal of the license. And I should mention that the Chicago Media Action, what was it, 2-3 years ago?
2005. November 2005.
In 2005, we challenged every broadcast license of every broadcaster in this, in the city of Chicago, claiming that they had failed to serve the public interest. And they're all still there, unfortunately.
The case, though, is still pending at the FCC. It's in its third appeal.
The case is still pending at the FCC, and I need to point out that we've cost these bastards, you know, thousands of dollars in legal fees.
Lots of paperwork.
So the fact that activists were able to win that right, to win public standing in license renewal procedures, they were able to win limits on the reach of networks, they were able to win a ban on cross-ownership of a owner of a radio or television station in a town, still to this day cannot also own a newspaper, the major daily newspaper in that town. The reason we have that arrangement here in Chicago is they were grandfathered in. We also had briefly in the 1970s and 80s incentives for minority and women ownership of broadcast outlets. And we had also something called the Fairness Doctrine, which required broadcasters to address controversial public issues and to air multiple sides of those, multiple points of view on those issues.
That was Steve Masek speaking on October 12, 2009. To learn more about the Open University of the Left, go online to www.openuniversityoftheleft.org. To learn more about Chicago Media Action, go online to www.chicagomediaaction.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.